This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. There are now hundreds of people living on the streets around the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnea Cass Boulevard. Over the last few weeks, we have been bringing you news of the worsening crisis there. It's one rooted in substance use disorder and homelessness. Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins has been watching tents go up there with dismay and now has his own idea for how to address the humanitarian crisis. Renovate a now vacant section of the South Bay House of Corrections to house and treat people struggling with addiction and experiencing homelessness. And Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins is on the line now. Sheriff Tompkins, welcome back.
Ms. Deering, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you, and I appreciate you joining us. I wonder if I could ask you to start by just outlining what you're proposing, please, Sheriff Tompkins.
So in discussion with the individuals, the businesses in the Newmarket Square area, and some of the residents in the South End, we've been talking about ways in which we could be a part of the solution. And I just happen to have a facility on my campus that is now vacant for the most part. And so the thought is, let's find a way to get people off the street and get them into housing where they would have shelter, food, the medication that they need, showers, and the like. And we just think it's a smart idea to get people in a confined space when the winter is coming, and it's going to get incredibly cold here. And so we've begun discussions with the state and the city, as well as some of the community businesses and residents, to talk about whether or not this is a viable idea, a viable option. And to this point, most people think that it is a good idea.
So I think the sticky wicket, if I understand it, Sheriff Tompkins, is the question of whether one would go voluntarily or not. And as I understand it, this could be an involuntary commitment.
No, that's not necessarily the case. What we're looking at right now, because of Section 35, and I'm not sure what your audience knows about Section 35, but simply put, that's a civil commitment. We are looking at individuals that already have outstanding warrants, and so they are engaged with the legal system in some capacity. The question is to what degree, whether it's something that's major or something that's minor. And if we begin in that way, I think we get around the civil commit portion of this right now, but there also are a lot of people out there that do not have any engagement with the legal system that also need the help that we can provide. So that's going to be meted out by the courts and by the district attorney as to who could come here. And once that is figured out, then we will work with that population and get them the necessary things, that the resources that they need so that they can work to get clean and sober.
So this is a real opportunity to comb this out a little bit more, Sheriff Tompkins, especially because, as you say, many of our listeners may not understand this. So I'm going to feed back to you what I think I just heard. So you're saying wave one, my words, not yours, would be people who were already in some way touching or engaged in the criminal justice system. And those would be people that you would be seeking to move into this excess capacity at South Bay. So part one, am I understanding you correctly?
Correct.
Okay. And then part two, people may or may not know that there is a process called Section 35 that families can go through with a court to essentially have somebody involuntarily committed for substance use treatment if they are a danger to themselves or others. And you're leaving that door open as a possible second path in, but it is not the first thing for which you're suggesting or advocating. Do I understand you again?
That is correct.
Okay. So how many people are we talking about, Sheriff Tompkins? You have said there's capacity for up to 100 beds. Are you talking about 100 people at a time?
Yes, actually.
And yes. Do you feel like, because again, understanding this real time with you as we go along, do you feel like there are enough people who are now present in that neighborhood who are engaged with the criminal justice system or have outstanding warrants, et cetera, that you could fill 100 beds at South Bay?
The aim here is to get as many people in a secure setting where we can help them, whether that's 25, 50, 75, or 100. What I'm saying is I have a max capacity of 100.
Okay.
And so if it's 25, okay, I'm good with that also. The thing here is that we need to get people in a position where they can get the help that they need to get back up on their feet. Or in some cases, people may come in and we just need to do an assessment, and their family members can then say, hey, you know, I've got a space for them. I'd rather them be at home than to be in your facility. And so what I'm saying is we have a max of 100.
So let's stay in the how would this work space a little bit longer, Sheriff Tompkins. Mm-hmm. These are folks who will have complex, potentially complex medical needs, certainly complex social intervention needs. Are you talking about the sheriff's office running this? And two, if so, you know, forgive me for being skeptical that our law enforcement as the opening orientation has the capacity to address in an environment like that all the complex needs that somebody who's maybe at the intersection of substance abuse disorder, substance use disorder, and homelessness may have.
Well, there's a couple of things there. First and foremost, when you go to a facility like ours, the state really becomes your primary healthcare practitioner. So on my site, in my facility, I have a full-blown mental health unit, I have a full-blown substance abuse team. This is what we do. And because of what's going on outside of our walls, the scarcity of beds to service people with either mental health challenges or substance abuse issues, if they do something that's untoward, they oftentimes wind up here anyway, you see. And what we really need, and I've talked to legislators about this endlessly, is that more money needs to be put out there so that you have beds out there, out in the community, not in a facility like mine. But because there aren't that many beds that can do that, to service that, all we're saying is this is one way that we can address this situation, and it could be a very short-term situation for several individuals or a lot of individuals, but let's begin the process of getting them the help that they need. The second part of your question about law enforcement. Law enforcement really is here to serve, to protect, and to serve. And I do believe when I talk to law enforcement professionals, they are very concerned about what's going on in the streets. Right now, right around my facility, you have an open-air drug market. You have the drug trade that's being done every day. I mean, when I drove in this morning, I actually witnessed three people shooting up. You have an element of human trafficking happening now. This past weekend, one of the tents caught on fire, and that happened again this afternoon. And so we've got a situation that's getting really, 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 really bad. So this is a conversation. Just let me finish this up, please. This is a conversation that's being had with a number of entities, state, local, police, caseworkers, sheriff's department, community residents, and businesses.
So as you're having this conversation with multiple entities, I'm sure many of them are aware, and I'm sure it's in the back of your mind, that there have been a number of deaths in our carceral system, including Aisha Johnson at South Bay a couple months ago. She was admitted on a Section 35. Are you receiving any pushback from this idea, given, you know, Suffolk County DA is investigating that death? There are three others that have come into question. Are you receiving any pushback about capacity, given those recent events?
No, but let me explain this to you. And this is what people don't understand. So they say that there's been three or four deaths in our facility in the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks. What people don't understand is this. Three of the four people were with us for less than 48 hours. We are receiving people here that have some serious medical issues. And so what we do when you come in and you're under our jurisdiction, we immediately give you a physical. We immediately find out what your medical situation is. And two of the three people, I believe, and don't quote me on this, I'd have to check with our medical department, actually expired in our medical unit. When they came in and we found out what their medical needs were, we did not send them to the general population. We sent them to the infirmary where they passed away. Now, let me just say this to you about the Section 35s. We are, meaning the sheriff's department, we are kind of the ferry system for the courts. We are mandated by the legislators to move people from the courts to either a correction facility or wherever they're going to go if they're looking for help or are going to receive help. And so the young lady that you mentioned, although she falls under the heading of Section 35, she was here principally waiting for a ride to go to another facility.
So
here's what happens when you come in with the Section 35. Because of the Section 35 laws, we cannot give them a medical. We cannot give them a medical physical because of Section 35. And so she was sitting in our booking area waiting for the bus to leave to take her to where she was going. Let me also tell you this.
So, no, actually, I want to stop you there, and I appreciate you giving me that information. But also, Sheriff, I know you're exasperated with me. Stay with me on this because this is how we dig this out, right? So if you're not able to do that, if you're not authorized with the Section 35, for example, mm-hmm. doesn't that underscore potential vulnerability of somebody who might come into the system and be in withdrawal or in need of immediate substance use treatment? Do you have the ability, the authorization, and the capacity to provide that kind of urgent, immediate care if that is the need?
Yes,
when someone comes.
Yes, we have it. Yes, we have it. No, we can't because of the Section 35 law. Yes, we can do it, but no, we can't do it.
But in the what law. You're proposing, can you do it? In what you're proposing here at Mass and Cass with this new capacity, would you be able to do that?
And that's why we're looking at people with warrants, so that, yes, they come in and we can give them the help that they need immediately.
That's really helpful clarification. So then I have one last question for you.
But there's one last thing I've got to say before you go there.
Okay.
So what families have called us to say, we want information about our family members that have expired. Here's how they get that information. Because of HIPAA laws, I cannot, once again, give them that information. But what they can do is they can petition the courts to have the courts make them the representatives of their family member. Once that's done, then they can go to the medical examiner and get the information that they seek. I can't do it, but the medical examiner can do it once the courts have given those individuals the right to do that. And that's crucially important to know.
And I suspect that over time, as this issue gets played out, we're gonna look more and more at these processes. Before I let you go, I guess my last question to you, you and I have talked in a number of venues over the years. I'm aware of how aware you are. Has something gone seriously wrong that you are having to propose this as an option? Like, is this a last resort that you wish you didn't have to propose, but we're not getting it done in other ways?
You know, for America to be as vibrant it is, as wealthy as it is, for us to have the overwhelming number of homelessness, people suffering from homelessness, mental health, and substance abuse issues that we are not taking care of. This is not just germane to Massachusetts or Boston. This is across the country. So as a country, we really have to figure out how we want to prioritize the dollars that are being spent in that whole healthcare arena. In other words, we need to get in front of the curve where the cost won't be as much to help people versus behind the curve where it's incrementally more expensive to do. And that it really does infuriate me that we are here where we're at right now because of the fact that we are not addressing this mental health, substance abuse, and homelessness situation in a way that makes sense. So is this the last resort? More than likely it is, but it's an option. And so what we're saying is this is an option. Let's begin the conversation and let's see how we can make this work. Or if there are others outside of a correction facility that can do it, fine, then go for it. We are wide open to that, but we want the discussion to begin in earnest, and let's begin to really help people, get them off the street, and get them the care that they need.
That is Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins. Sheriff, really appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Listening in on that conversation was WBUR's Deborah Becker, who has been covering the Mass and Cass situation extensively. Deb, welcome back.
Thank you.
So a lot there, Deb. I just want to sort of let you go in reacting to what you just heard.
Well, I think that Sheriff Tompkins makes a point that there needs to be action taken in that area and deal with some of the problems, the continuing problems that we see there. But I think what I heard is Section 35 under a different name, but it's still Section 35. And while the sheriff said that folks who would be taken to his vacant facility under his plan would be those with outstanding warrants, so they would have some involvement in the criminal justice system, others who did not not have that involvement in the criminal justice system would still go to the facility, but that would be up to police and the district attorney, which, of course, is Section 35. You are involuntarily committing people to a treatment facility under the state law, but you are putting them in a correctional facility even though no crime has been committed. So I think that's the key part of this plan, and that's the part that is resulting in a lot of debate.
So, Deb, Section 35, I mean, there was one lawsuit about how Section 35 is executed for women in the Commonwealth. Policy was changed as a result. There's another lawsuit about how Section 35 is executed for men. I'm sorry, that's probably not the right word, but you understand what I'm saying. Any clarification for us there? And what do you want to tell us about what prisoner advocates are saying about Tompkins' plan?
Right. So prisoners' advocates filed suit about putting people in correctional facilities when they're involuntarily committed to treatment and they haven't committed any crimes. And so that suit was resolved, one suit was resolved in 2016, but that suit only mentioned women. So the state now can no longer send women to correctional facilities if they're involuntarily committed to treatment. There's another suit that's pending involving men, which would result in the same thing, that the state would be barred from using correctional facilities for men. And Bonnie Tenoriello is an attorney with Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts, and she's the one working on this lawsuit. And she says the bottom line to her is that correctional facilities are not places for treatment. Let's listen.
The stigma and shame that is conveyed by putting someone in correctional custody, those are completely contrary to treatment.
Tenoriello says instead the state should be putting resources into treatment and providing adequate services in a medical setting.
So, Deb, there were some things that the sheriff outlined in our conversation with him just now that was more detailed than at least I had going into the conversation with him. One, were there any surprises for you in what the sheriff told us? And two, if there was any new information there, did you hear anything that might change the minds of those who are really concerned about his proposal?
I don't think so, because as I said, I think it's Section 35, but under a different name, and getting around some of the restrictions of the Section 35 law regarding providing medical treatment in correctional facilities to those who are involuntarily committed and dealing with those without standing warrants. So I think that it's the same debate, but it may not be under Section 35 specifically, which, as we said, is the subject of this litigation and does already have restrictions on it in the way the law is written.
So you heard at the end there when I asked him, is this a suggestion because other things have failed? And he basically said, somebody's got to do it. I'm trying to offer a solution here. The problems do seem to be getting worse there, Deb. You know, twice in the last couple of weeks, you've used the term deteriorating. I think I did too, right? So talk a little more about that.
Yeah, I mean, folks describe it as a humanitarian crisis, really. And it is, you know, it's very sad to be there, to see the tents and hundreds of people and people nodding off and people openly using illegal drugs and people really suffering. It's difficult. It's difficult to listen to area businesses who say, what am I supposed to do? I'm boarding up my windows. I'm putting up extra security. There's a mess everywhere and I can't keep up with the cleanup. And I think everyone recognizes that it's a problem. And actually today, during the legislative committee hearing on bills related to addiction, I was listening into that, and State Senator Julian Sear, who's chair of the Joint Committee on Mental Health Substance Use and Recovery, mentioned his recent visits to the Mass and Cass area. And this is what he said.
It is a pretty, honestly, I'm shocked that the city and the state have allowed it to get to that point. I think we need some pretty swift intervention.
So everyone keeps saying, intervene, do something, somebody do something. So Sheriff Tompkins, I think, is correct in saying something needs to change to address the issues in that area. But as you've talked about on the show, there are many proposals that have come forward and they haven't gone anywhere.
All right. So let's turn for just a minute to a different topic. We talked to you about it last week. You reported that the new ombudsman for the State Department of Corrections, still dealing with corrections, it was the first ombudsman, had been placed on paid administrative leave after WBUR asked about his background. I understand you've now learned that ombudsman Seth Peters was terminated by UMass Chan Medical School. What can you tell us?
Well, I think the medical school issued a brief statement this morning saying that Seth Peters is no longer employed by the school. The school had placed Peters on administrative leave last week after WBUR asked if he's the same Seth Peters who was involved in a 2012 wrongful death suit. That suit alleged that Peters, while working as a UMass EMT, falsified records about having a patient in cardiac arrest walk down three flights of stairs and the patient later died. So the school says it is now looking for an interim DOC ombudsman.
So you broke this, Deb, using publicly available resources. So what does that say about the vetting process that was used in the first place?
Well, I think it clearly raises questions about the vetting process, and lawmakers are asking about that. You could say that this suit was a long time ago, and perhaps folks didn't look too deeply into him. It appears that Mr. Peters has accomplished a lot since then. He was a public health officer in the Air National Guard, and he was working in epidemiology in Rhode Island and in Worcester.
So this is about overseeing how the pandemic is being managed in state prisons. Pretty important. What happens with the ombudsman post now?
Well, the school says it will look for someone else. It will look for an interim and then continue to search for a permanent ombudsman. Members of the legislature's Criminal Justice Reform Caucus wrote to UMass Medical School today, asking it to consider the candidacy of Dr. Monique Jimenez. She's an epidemiologist at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. State Representative Mary Keefe and State Senator Jamie Eldridge said in the letter that it's urgent to get someone in that position. They say Dr. Jimenez was vetted by the state attorney general's office for the role and is eager to assume the position. And we should mention 21 prisoners in Massachusetts have died from the virus since the pandemic began, not including two men who were granted medical parole shortly before their deaths from COVID, so they were no longer considered in state custody.
All right, that's WBUR's Deb Becker. Deb, thanks.
You're welcome.
Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell joins us now for her first public conversation since the preliminary election 2 weeks ago. Councilor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
I'm glad to have you. I'd love to be a little human as we start, Councilor Campbell, and just ask you, how you doing?
I'm doing well. If anything, looking forward to getting a little rest. I haven't had any since. I've been making a lot of thank you calls and I had to attend a couple of funerals, actually, for some supporters, but doing well and looking forward to what's next.
I'm sorry for those losses. I do want to say that. And are you at a moment where you're at peace with how things have unfolded? Have you had enough time to sort of settle in your mind?
Yes. I mean, I'm always at peace. Most folks who know me really well know that I'm a very faith-driven person. And so my heart is filled with peace because of that. And as I told my team and my staff that continue to work really hard, including in these final days to wrap up, that everything we had control over, we did exceptionally well. And we centered people in this campaign. We led with integrity, compassion, honesty, and substance. And there's no regrets. And now it just tells us that the work continues, but in different ways.
So there's so much we could talk about, but I feel like you kind of picked our first subject for us with your op-ed in the Boston Globe on endorsements. You said in it that you weren't going to endorse either of the candidates, you know, Boston City Councilors Michelle Wu, Anissa Saibi-George, until each had laid out specific steps for how she would close inequity gaps facing Black communities to Boston's Black communities, that centered approach you just talked about. Why put that stake in the ground, and what are you trying to either accomplish or head off by laying that stake out?
It was really important to me to remind folks that this campaign and my candidacy was about honesty, integrity, substance, but most importantly, centering the people. You know, no backroom deals, no conversations behind the scenes. Everything was forward facing and bottom up. And so that won't change going forward. And it really is, I think, the time to change not only the narrative, but to end the sort of backroom deal strategy that has consistently failed to move the agenda and to move on issues that affect our Black and brown communities. And of course, evidenced by COVID. So I want specifics. You know, what are the candidates going to do to address not only the inequities in housing and education, but mass and caste? which is having a disproportionate effect, particularly on Black men in overdoses. What are they going to do to address public health inequities, economic inequities, the racial wealth gap, tangible specifics, and accountability? All of that is critically important to me because it's also critically important to my supporters. And so I will sit down with both candidates to have those conversations and to push for them to make specifics.
So a couple follow-up questions there. You used the term backroom deal a couple of times, which, of course, what's hanging in my head is the fact that over the weekend, Acting Mayor Janey endorsed City Councilor Michelle Wu for mayor of Boston, saying she thinks Wu is best equipped to address racial and systemic inequities facing the city. Are you concerned that that was not sufficiently transparent, that there was some sort of backroom nature to it?
It wasn't public facing. So the question I'm left with is, what again specifically is Councilor Wu going to do as mayor to address the inequities? And I'll give you one example. I still live in Mattapan, and the children here still have a 5% chance of getting into a high quality Boston public school compared to some downtown neighborhoods where it's 80%. My people want specifics on how you're going to change that. And why this is necessary is because residents, especially residents of color and Black residents, distrust the political system so much because they have been promised things for generations where those promises have been broken. And so if we want to change this game and to really encourage folks not only to vote, but to be engaged with government and to be a part of that, we really have to change the way we do things. And that's how I'm going to continue to lead.
So tell us what it looks like. So the two candidates sit down, they have a conversation with you. Is that done in public? Do you report it back out in public? What policy items do you need to hear? How does it look when it's done differently and you then say, okay, that was people-centered, and now I'm going to endorse?
That's right. So I will meet with both candidates. They, of course, have both asked, and I think it's extremely important. But my ask will be to them just that. What in their plans or what are they developing that will specifically meet the needs of residents of color, especially Black residents? What are the tangible, measurable things? How will they deliver racial equity in health, housing, schools, public safety? And I'll give you one example. Policing reform. I had a very specific plan on how to make our department more transparent and accountable, root out racial disparities, invest in the root causes of violence. That all came from community. What are their plans on that? Mass and caste, the same thing. And it will be public afterwards. So I will, you know, obviously have that conversation, give them the opportunity to share on their specifics, and then make a decision on whether or not I endorse in this race based on that plan. Because what I heard loud and clear from my constituents is they want it to be public. They want commitments to be made public, and they want them to be tangible and specific so that they can wrap their head around it. And also they can see it's achievable, but they can most importantly hold the person accountable once they become mayor of the city of Boston.
All right, let's pick up on the two policy issues you just brought up, and we'll use this sort of as a follow-on. Any deal breakers for you? So, for example, among your proposals on police reform was cutting a minimum of $50 million from the police operating budget and universal body cam use. Are those deal breakers for you? Do you need to see a candidate who wants to go where you wanted to go on that issue?
I'm not being that strict, but I do want to see alignment. So I do want to see someone who is talking about ways in which to make our department more transparent and accountable, to fully implement OPAT, to establish a public safety dashboard, to expand body cameras across the department.
And just to clarify, sorry, OPAT is the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency.
That's right. And to, of course, look at the budget, which is not sustainable, and to come up with a strategy on ways on how to make that budget sustainable while reinvesting in the root causes of violence, because police alone will never be able to solve violence in the city of Boston. But I also want specifics on education. Are you going to establish a VOTEC system, for example, where Madison Park is the center of that system? Are you going to make changes to our assignment process to allow particularly children of color who don't have access to high quality schools finally have access? What are your plans to improve the failing schools within Boston Public Schools? What are your plans to close the racial wealth gap? What are your plans to support businesses run by people of color? Transportation deserts. I really want to see those specifics, not just value statements or big ideas. And I think that is critically important because that's what I heard from my supporters. So, they loved our work because it was specific and the plans were tangible.
So Madison Park is one example that makes me think of this. You know, you and John Barrios, neither of you have endorsed yet. Any possibility that the two of you form a center of gravity on some of the policy issues that the two of you shared in common or believed strongly in to try to move these candidates where you want to see the policy outcomes be? And any chance you just don't endorse because you're not satisfied?
I can't speak to Barrows and what he plans to do. I only made it clear what I plan to do and that I want to continue to lead in such a way that the people are centered in this and that it is not only about centering them, but it's also doing work and putting out ideas that will actually have an impact on the issues they care about. And for that impact to happen, it needs to be data-driven. There needs to be metrics. It needs to be tangible. And they need to be specific. And that's what I want to see more of as it pertains to communities of color and Black residents in the city of Boston. And they both have work to do there. I'm looking forward to those conversations to hear from them directly what that looks like. And then if I decide to endorse, I will stand with them because they've made those commitments to the people of the city of Boston, especially to Black and Brown residents in the city.
So I do want to talk to you about what comes next for you. But before we do that, we've just talked for a long time about the things you want to do to make sure that communities of color are centered in the remainder of this race and in the next mayor's policy priorities. I'm sure you're aware, I know you're aware, that probably the biggest postmortem since the preliminary election has been the question of whether Black voters in particular were split, whether it was a good thing or an unhealthy thing to have three Black candidates who together took 42% of the vote, a plurality of the vote. We've run every scenario and talked to all kinds of commentators here on Radio Boston. What is your position now?
My position from the very beginning of the race was that there was more than enough room for more than one Black candidate to run. And I still believe that to be true. What I see the work needs to be going forward is voter engagement, is really going into communities, particularly communities of color, where that deep distrust exists, and to really explaining why these systems, the political systems, matter and why it touches their daily life. So there's work to do around voter engagement. I think in this race, there were also missed opportunities. We had too many folks stand on the sidelines, including elected officials, who didn't necessarily have to endorse, but didn't get out to actually encourage folks to vote in this historic election. That's a problem. And I also will say the media. We needed more substantive coverage of this race, and it came very late, more than one TV debate. There were so many folks who saw one debate and said, is there more to come? I need to learn more. I want to know more. And so we give more coverage to the federal and state races, gubernatorial races. The local races need just as much coverage because of how significant they are. So we have a lot more work to do. And I'm excited for what lies ahead, particularly in mobilizing and engaging residents and communities of color on the issues that they care about that also need to be addressed in the city of Boston.
All right. You mentioned earlier another issue for the city, which is mass and cast. You may be aware that before you joined us today, we talked with Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, who has a proposal to use essentially excess capacity at South Bay Correctional Facility involuntarily house and treat people who are experiencing substance use disorder and homelessness. He and I went back and forth a lot about whether or not this is Section 35. I guess my primary question to you is, are you aware of his plan? What is your reaction to his plan? And have we gotten to the point where we've run out of other creative approaches?
I have read it, and I will say this is what's been really deeply disturbing to me, because during the campaign, of course, I've been lifting up this issue as the issue and the other public health crisis that was not getting the action it needed from the city and the state, and developed a plan in partnership with a whole host of stakeholders on the ground back in January of this year. And so I do think there are options on the table that the city of Boston can take to get people housed in supportive housing, to deal with the homelessness crisis, to get folks the services they need, and to push the state to do more. What has been the problem is the inaction and the lack of urgency. I've heard that every step of the way. So before we go to a sort of a criminalization piece, Section 35. I think there are options on the table that need to be exhausted, and that requires action by the city, and by the acting mayor.
What is getting in the way, Counselor? You've talked about the sort of the inaction. What is getting in the way?
The inaction, twofold, I think. One is it's just that inaction, whether it was the previous mayor or the acting mayor, and I spoke very candidly about that, and the defensive posture that the current administration is taking on these issues. I was in many forums where they were suggesting things are getting better, and I was just shocked because that wasn't the case. And I do think it has to be led by the mayor's office. That is critically important. And until that happens, you're going to have different stakeholders trying to develop their own plans, and it's not going to be coordinated. So the mayor's office has to drive it, and the state equally also has to step up working in partnership with the city. But both have to get off, you know, their bums and do the work. And I'm going to keep pushing on this issue because I care deeply about the city of Boston, and that shouldn't exist here.
All right, let's look ahead a little bit. One of the things that's been on my mind a bunch is, regardless of who wins in November, the Boston City Council will have some huge changes. I'm thinking back to some of the pictures of that class of women of color who all came in together in the Boston City Council. I'm sure you remember some of those pictures. You were in them, right? All of a sudden, one way or another, you will not be on the council anymore. Michelle Wu will not be on the council anymore. Kim Janey, Anissa Saibi George, Lydia Edwards is now running for a state senate office. That is a powerful group of women leaders, women of color with experience, who are all going to be gone from that body. I mean, no disrespect to other strong leaders on the council or those who are running for election, but that's a big change. What's the future of the council, and how do you think about that?
It is a big change, but it's also exciting at the same time, because we're going to elect some new blood, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. I don't think any of these positions should be designed in such a way that you are sitting in these seats forever. And so I'm excited to work with whoever the new counselors are to make sure that they have whatever they need to be successful, including someone, you know, who will replace me. And I'm excited about the possibilities going forward. I know I'm not going anywhere. The work very much continues in this city. I still care deeply about the issues. It never was about me, maybe my leadership, but not me per se. It's about the people. And they want to see changes and progress in policing reform, on mass and cast, in our Boston public schools, in the economy. So many issues to work on. So I'm excited about the possibilities and working with all of the stakeholders in this great ecosystem that we have in the city of Boston to finally get some things done on the issues that matter the most to residents and especially people of color.
And what do you have to get done before you leave the council in your mind?
I have to make sure that OPAD is up and running, the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, really important. And then some, of course, issues around Boston Public Schools and parents and students returning, mass and cast. So there's still a lot on the table that I'm excited to work on. And then, of course, to transition to the next District 4 leader who will pick up the mantle, and I will support that individual as well, and excited about doing that.
And advice for that individual and for the next mayor?
Be bold and courageous, and don't be afraid to work with folks around you, right? There's a lot of work to do, and I'm going to support that person. And I think that's critically important. As we sort of talk about succession planning, it's important that we all work together to get things done. And I'm excited about doing just that.
All right. So I want to know, do you know what's next for you? And are you going to tell us?
I'm going to take time with my beautiful husband and my two beautiful boys. And then I'm going to think about it and not rush into the next thing. And I'm excited for the possibilities to continue to serve the city, of course, and to continue to do the work in some way and in some capacity.
Anything you want to leave with our listeners today?
I have been thinking a lot about my supporters and those who stepped up, many of whom never worked on campaigns before, including the fellows and young students we had a part of this campaign. And I'm grateful to them. I'm telling them to not give up any sense of hope. The work continues, and we must continue it as a collective to ensure that this city is indeed equitable for everyone. And I'm excited about the possibilities that lie ahead for the city of Boston.
All right. That is former mayoral candidate and Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell. Councilor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
one lone sound echoed through our major sports stadiums in Greater Boston this weekend. Do you know what it was?
You're really going to make me do this, aren't you?
I am. Do it.
Plonk.
That's right. Plunk. It's all I could think of. All right. All weekend, Chris, you're a sport. It's plunk. And that is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick agreeing to play along to help us check the score after the Red Sox dropped the ball with the Yankees this weekend repeatedly. And,
you know, it's really not kind to toy with my emotions like this. Plunk.
Plunk. And Mac Jones got plunked on his back repeatedly during the
page.
Yeah, before what could be a major plunking next weekend when Tom Brady comes to town. So let's check all of it. Chris, thank you for playing along. That's all I could think of. You know, a little over a week ago, you're here. We talk about the Sox looking like they're headed for a wild card playoff berth. Here come the Yankees, and holy cow.
Yeah, I blame you. You went Friday night and ended the winning streak. I don't know what you did to him. No, this
you,
was
you
a,
accused
a brutal...
me during the game of being there and jinxing it. It's true.
I did, absolutely. I mean, absolutely brutal weekend. As you said, they were kind of set up pretty well for a playoff run. They still could get in, but I just want to touch on this series because it is, I think, really telling about this team. And I thought the Red Sox coach, Alex Cora, really kind of summed it up with reporters after last night's loss.
But guess what about the Yankees? And we're in the second wild card. We played some competitive games, but we didn't get the job done. So very simple.
Didn't get the job done. I got to say, we got swept by the Yankees, probably six of my least favorite words in the English language. But it was interesting because it really almost did feel like that early 2000s rivalry, especially last night, an incredible game. But the Yankees, over the course of the weekend, really just outclassed the Red Sox. They outscored the Sox 19-9 in the series. The Red Sox gave up 8 runs in the 8th inning of the last 2 games, which is just not a good way to close out games. It's a surefire way to lose. And Giancarlo Stanton just almost single-handedly destroyed this team. He goes 7-for-12, hits 3 home runs over 3 games, 10 RBIs, which means that Stanton produced more runs than the entire Red Sox team over the 3-game series.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, not only because that's painful, and I just don't want to hear about it anymore, but also because plunk. I mean, you're talking about this masterful performance by the Yankees. I've never seen more baseball players drop balls than I did in those 3 games. And I think for people who are maybe not even sports fans, you get that. I mean, when you're a baseball player, you have a mitt. There is a ball. The thing you're supposed to do is catch it. And there was so many drop
balls.
That's
metaphorical.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Here we're actually, no, they actually dropped the ball. I mean, it started Friday night, the game you were at with Kyle Schwarber. In his defense, playing first base, a position he does not usually play. The Red Sox brought him in before the trade deadline and kind of sold us on this idea that they were going to convert him to a first baseman instead of, you know, spending a little money and getting an actual first baseman out there. Well, that's, I guess, an issue for another day. But to see the way this team looks, it really, in the week leading up to this series over this weekend, it looked like they were starting to kind of capture something magical and build that momentum that you do need to make a deep playoff run. They're all in on wearing the yellow jerseys, and you felt like there was something special, and then they just fall absolutely flat on their faces this weekend. Just a brutal way to go into the last week of the season here.
And I want to point out this point about Schwarber at first base. In case people don't understand what an epically big deal it is to bring someone in like that, there is an entire scene in the famous movie Moneyball about the desire to do just that, bring somebody who's in first base in, who's not first base, and play it. And the team trainer is like, it's incredibly hard. That just can't happen. Right? So, like, this is a thing. So, again, for the...
then it's this myth like, oh, first base isn't that hard to play, right? You can teach anybody to play first base. But what you saw is what happens when you bring in somebody who is not in their natural position and ask them to do things they're not used to doing. They've spent an entire career seeing the ball from a different angle. And so now when he has to look at that pop-up and figure out how deep he needs to be in the infield, he doesn't have the institutional knowledge to do that.
Okay. I'm just saying, though, Yankees dropped some balls, too, in yesterday's game. So just, nah. Yankees did it as well.
But Stanton's the first Yankee since 1954, Mickey Mantle, to hit 10 RBIs in a 3-game series against the Sox. So they did what they needed to do.
Yes, they did. Okay, so before we go to the Pats, because we must, very briefly, are they going to make it to the wild card even at this point?
So the schedule is in their favor. They have some pretty easy games to end the season here. I expect them to sneak in and grab that second wild card spot. I don't know that they'll overtake the Yankees, which would mean they would have to play the Yankees in a one-game wild card playoff game. And based on this weekend, I don't know how you can feel good about that.
And just to clarify, one game, because that's the way the system works now, right? It's a sort of like a sudden death, you know, Boston versus New York grudge match kind of thing.
Yeah, I can already hear my dad taunting me when that comes to pass.
All right, so let's move to the Patriots, because Mac Jones got plunked on his backside a bajillion times in a very literally and figuratively painful Patriots game yesterday, too.
He did, and I think it's unfair, though, to pin this loss on him. The Patriots lose to
the New
Orleans Saints.
Oh, no, I'm not pinning it on him. I think he just got plastered.
Well, it's just interesting because before the season, so much thought and conversation around this team was about, will a rookie quarterback have what it takes to help this team compete, right? We kind of assumed the defense would be good enough. We talked about all the money they spent on the offseason for offensive weapons. And so far, it looks like the offensive weapons they brought in stink. I mean, Jonnu Smith kind of summed it all up in one play. So the Patriots were down 14-3 at the half. And then to start the second half, here's what happened.
They're down a running back right now in James White, so we'll see how they contend with that.
They'll fake it to start. Oh, disastrous play to begin the half, and Malcolm Jenkins is going to cruise home for a pick six.
So Mac Jones puts the ball right on Jonnu Smith's hands, and he just kind of bats it up in the air, and Malcolm Jenkins just says, whoop, I'll take that. Thanks, and right off to the end zone. Now you're down 21-3, and that really became just too big a hole to climb out of.
That's right. And for those of you who don't know what a pick six is, that's called insult added to injury, because they take the ball from you, and then they take it all the way into the end zone and score on the ball they just took from you because you messed up.
Right. Their offense never even has to come on the field, basically. They'll take the points.
That's right. And then you have to come back. Okay. So, Chris, I'm thinking ahead to this weekend. We got about 2 minutes left here, because it feels like a bad John Hughes high school movie where the former star, you know, mega quarterback gets to come back and rub the new kid's face in the dirt at prom or something. That's what it feels like is coming.
I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say this is the biggest regular season game Boston has seen ever. I mean, you're talking about... Tom Brady, the greatest player to ever play his sport, never mind his position, coming back to town with the team he left you for and won a Super Bowl with. And I'll tell you, the Buccaneers, who Tom Brady plays for now, lost this week, which is like worst case scenario, because now you know he's going to be fired up and they are going to come in looking to absolutely embarrass Bill Belichick and the Patriots.
Okay, so you always bring us outstanding Bill Belichick sound. Do you have
some? Oh, yeah. Well, this is what's going to be really fascinating in the week leading up, because he's going to have to answer all these questions. So after trying to say that he has talked about Brady leaving in the past, Tom E. Curran really pressed him and says, no, you haven't talked about that. And he got into this exchange with reporters after the game yesterday.
We made a statement when Tom left, and that covered it.
You surprised how well he's played? He's thrown 61 touchdown passes in 23 games down there. Won a Super Bowl.
Yeah, Tom's a great player. Nothing surprises me that he does.
Just seeing how well Brady's played the last few years, do you wish that you had made the Patriots a better option for him to return?
Yeah, again, I think we've already covered that.
He is loving it, right?
Right, that is
all. This is the guy who for 9 minutes talked about a punter one week. So it'll be really interesting to see what does he say about Tom Brady, the greatest player at his position, arguably the greatest player in football history, coming back, the guy he wanted out of town. What's it going to be? It's going to be a really interesting week, that's for sure.
We will watch it with you. Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, folks, that's the show. Ouch. I'm Deciana Deering. Thanks for listening. This is Radio Boston.